you may approach, and I'll let you get your things to council's table. Would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes? I think I should repeat, because most attorneys here were not here when we opened court. Each side has 15 minutes to argue, and as appellant's counsel, would you like to reserve a portion of that 15 minutes for rebuttal?
I would, Judge.
How much?
About 5 minutes.
All right. You have it, Ms. Fuller, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Okay. May it please the court, I'm Barbara Fuller on behalf of the appellant, Jane Frakes.
And you, why don't you come forward to the lectern, and that way, because the arguments, as you may know, are recorded, and we'll be able to hear you better here and on the recording if you're there at the lectern.
Okay, thank you. Judge, this matter was taken up on three assignments of error. The first assignment was based on the determination that jointly owned real property that was located in Vicksburg, Michigan, was a separate property of Danny Joe Frakes, who was a husband. And by failing to award any of that, the proceeds from the sale of that property to Jane Frakes, my argument, Judge, is that during the marriage, Danny Joe Frakes, who's the husband in this case, voluntarily transferred the property from himself alone to himself and Jane Frakes. That transfer was an unambiguous transfer without any restriction.
Ms. Fuller, I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument, but given the fact that you're talking about the Michigan deed, on its face, though, it appears that the transfer is from both of the Frakes to themselves. So how would you say that that's not unambiguous on its face?
It was from the husband himself to both parties during the marriage. The initial deed was in his name alone.
Because so he inherited it.
He inherited the property,
he did,
correct.
But if you look at the actual Michigan deed, doesn't it actually indicate that the transfer was
Understanding. It was my understanding that it was transferred from him because he was the sole owner of the property prior to the transfer, and that the deed actually transferred it from himself solely to himself and his spouse during the marriage. And there was no restriction on that transfer. I know there was...
It was a quit claim deed.
It was a
right.
quit claim deed.
Counsel,
there was...
You need to show donative intent, and how do you do that in this case? Where is the donative intent?
On the face of the deed itself. And there was also testimony that he transferred it voluntarily, and he testified that he transferred it for the purposes of... estate planning, essentially, so that if, in the event that something happened to him, the property would go to Mrs. Frakes. However, he certainly could have accomplished that goal in another way, if that was his intent, by...
But not necessarily to keep it out of probate. So if you want to keep it out of probate in Michigan, and they're living in Virginia, in order to have it jointly titled, wouldn't it immediately go and would go outside of probate?
That's maybe a reason. However, I think that it was inappropriate, since the deed was unambiguous on its face, for the court to consider any parole evidence at all. Under the Utch versus Utch case, the court indicated that if the property was intended to be transferred for one purpose, then it must be taken to have been intended to transfer for all purposes apparent on its face. So the parole evidence rule requires that when the language of the deed is clear, unambiguous, and explicit on its face, which my argument is that it was in this case, it was a transfer of the property, the court should not...
It doesn't have the sort of the statements of with love and affection or things that make it clear that it is for purposes of a gift that you might have found in some of the other cases.
There was nothing of that nature in the deed. That's correct. But it's my argument that the court should not look any further than the four corners of the instrument, which transferred the ownership equally to both of the parties. And in the end, the court should have classified it as...
Both of my colleagues just said, just because you have it transferred from one spouse to put it in both names doesn't show donative intent, that you intended it to be a gift as opposed to other reasons that one might decide to put one spouse's name on the property. And we have cases that say you have to show the donative intent.
Right, and 20-107.3 also provides that if the property is jointly titled, it should be considered to be marital property. And I understand that there is a
but that's if you can't trace it. This, it is into separate property, right?
And it may be retraceable by a preponderance of the evidence.
And is your position that in this particular case it's not retraceable by the preponderance? The court erred in that?
It's my position that the court erred in considering any parole evidence and by considering it to be separate property, because it was clear on its face that there was an intent, and it was even testified to that he intended to transfer the property for the purposes of estate planning. But if it was transferred for one purpose, it needs to be deemed to have been transferred for all purposes under the Utch case. And may I move on to the second? Okay. The second assignment of error was that the court erred in determining that the marital residence, the real property that was located at 700 Earl Street in Norfolk, Virginia, which was determined to have negative value, it was determined that there was negative value in the amount of $23,000, was subject to equitable distribution at all. Since the court found negative equity of $23,000, the Fox case controls here, in indicating that in Fox versus Fox, which cited Hodges v. Hodges, an asset with no value or with negative value is not subject to equitable distribution. And so the property should have been not have been awarded to Danny Joe Frakes. It should have been continued to be held as tenants by the entirety until some future event. And I understand that opposing party's argument is that it was a division of marital property, and it was within the sound discretion of the court, but the case law indicates that an asset is not an asset if it has negative value and it's not subject to equitable distribution.
But don't we have case law as well that says that marital assets and marital debt can be apportioned or distributed by the courts? So if they're
correct
debts.
But this wasn't a debt.
Mm-hmm.
It was a piece of property that has negative value, and as such, it was not appropriate to transfer it. It should have been continued to be held as tenants.
In some ways, isn't that the same thing, though? If you have a piece of property that's underwater, so to speak, it has value, but the mortgage on it, the loan on it, which was just in husband's name, if I recall correctly, If that outweighs it, then you do have a negative value to the asset, which is essentially indicative of a debt.
But the property itself is not a debt. It's a piece of property with a negative value. Well, the court determined that it had a negative value of $23,000, and as such, it should not have been distributed to the husband in this case. And my final assignment of error was that the court erred in making a monetary award of $44,400 to Danny Joe Frakes. There was no basis for the monetary award because there was negative value in the first place. The evidence in the case was that Mr. Frakes made investments in improvements in the property during the marriage, and obviously that turned out to be a very poor financial decision because the property went from $160,000 in value to $90,000 in value through the course of marriage. But those were decisions that were made by the parties during the marriage, and they're not subject to question by the court after the fact. Those investments were part of the property. The cost of improvements became part of the property, so we can't then again assess those costs to my client when the property includes those improvements, the cost of those improvements. Those were not debts. They were part of the value or negative value in this case of the marital residence, and as such are not subject to distribution as a marital debt. What the court did in this case was they took the $23,000 in negative equity, and added to that $88,000 of improvements that the former husband made during the marriage from his separate funds, and came up with $111,000, of which $40,000 was allocated to the wife. Now, that's, first of all, the $88,000 should have been considered part of the $23,000 because that was an asset, or not an asset with value, but an asset with negative value.
Is there any issue with the fact that, that there might be a problem with the classification of these assets as to whether some of the funds and the debt are marital or separate?
There is an issue because we don't know what portion of that those funds were earned during the marriage, if any portion of it. I believe the evidence was that part of the balance in each party's retirement account was accumulated during the, it was a 5-year marriage from date of marriage to the date of divorce, but I believe it was less than 3 years from the date of marriage to the date of separation. But clearly some of those increases in value occurred during the marriage, and as such would be part marital and part separately, and not entirely separate property.
I just want to remind you, you're going into your rebuttal time.
Okay.
You may proceed, or however you
wish. I will turn it over to Mr. Brown. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Sam Brown. I had the pleasure of representing Danny Frakes at the trial of this matter. I will address first the three errors. As to the Michigan property, the court properly stated that the wife never introduced testimony or evidence to refute the husband's claim that the transfer was for estate planning purposes only. The only testimony from the wife was that the husband wanted to put her name on the deed and that the two traveled to Michigan to spend a week there cleaning the property.
Counsel, do you have any position on Ms. Fuller's statement that the deed is unambiguous on its face?
It's a quitclaim deed. Mm-hmm. It's not a deed of gift. The Utch case clearly said that the conveyance was made by deed of gift and recited, quote, love and affection, end of quote, as consideration for the transfer. A quitclaim deed. Now, we do have Norfolk, and there was a deed of gift on Norfolk, and that became marital. And we didn't argue that that was ambiguous, but we did it properly in the using the Utch case. The court considered it and cited it during the course of the trial. But the quitclaim deed doesn't say love and affection, doesn't say anything. There's no donative intent. It was never intended to be a deed of gift. The unrefuted evidence was he did it for estate planning purposes only. Both parties came into this marriage. He came in with some property he inherited from his mother in 2000. She came into the marriage with her property in Georgia. Each had their own separate property before marriage. He did it just for estate planning purposes only. I'm going to go to the Norfolk property next, if I may. This is quite unusual. This property's out in Ocean View. Parties looked at it with a real estate agent, found the property is going to be their marital home. They had, and this is unrefuted, a plan where the husband would use his money to do the exterior, get it cleaned up, and the wife would use her money to do the interior. She was putting money aside in her Vanguard account. It was increasing in value. She was.
Let me interrupt you there, and I hate to do this long.
Sure.
I'm going to ask the same question that I asked Ms. Fuller. It seems that both parties would concede that the Norfolk residence is, in fact, marital. There may be a dispute about the apportionment of the debt. What about the Vanguard accounts and the other accounts? Where is it in the record that those are classified by the court as either marital or separate?
The court classified, let's start with the Southwest account, because she was an AirTrain flight attendant,
right,
and then Southwest acquired AirTrain, and that happened during the marriage. So Southwest, and the testimony was, she started this Southwest account as of December 2013, it had $23,000 in it. That was decided to be marital.
Well, actually, I think the court indicates at the time, didn't he say that it was $28,000 that was in the account?
It was $23,000, I'm sorry.
Okay. But in terms of the record, can you point me to any place in the record where the court actually definitively classifies those accounts as marital or separate property?
The court, in its ruling, made findings in the very beginning, starting on page one, ending on page two, of the valuation of these accounts.
Right, but where does it say whether they are marital or separate? It gives you what the accounts are and sort of recites the accounts, but
the court doesn't come out and in terms of the Fox, you know, three-step process, okay, I'll go to the actual Fox case itself.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Is there a problem in lieu of Fox?
Well, let me look at what the Fox case says in terms of the steps. The three basic steps are, one, classify the property. We put on evidence, okay, that during the marriage that the Southwest account became $23,000, okay? And we argued, and I don't find in the court's decision where he does, like some courts do, a summary of marital property and a summary of separate property. But I submit that in the record that it was considered to be marital property. And he did assign, the next step was to assign a value, and the third step is distribute the property. So in terms of...
But can you... I'm not disputing what evidence the parties may have put on in terms of trying to establish that, but what are we as the appellate court supposed to do if there's not a formal classification?
The court made initial findings on the second page, at the top of the page of its decision, as to the value of the wife's various accounts. Then it went as far to make a determination as to the increase in value during the marriage, and that's on page 4 of 6. He indicated that there was an increase in value, and although he doesn't come out and say this is marital property, I would argue that when the court says that it increased in value during the marriage of $80,000, and that the Southwest account had $23,000 as of the date of near the date of separation, and that there was an increase substantially of another account of a 401k, I submit that that is saying that's marital property. He doesn't come out and say this is marital property. When the trier of fact says this is what happened during the marriage, this is at the top of page 4 of its
Are you in the appendix? Where are you in the appendix?
I'm looking at the court's decision.
Okay.
But the court did not, during the trial, on the record, say I'm making a finding. He did make a finding of desertion. He did make findings of date of marriage and date of separation, but he never came out and made those findings. So we're bound by his ruling and his written opinion that he wrote. And I submit that at the top of page 4, these findings are meant to be marital property. And it was understood that if you have an increase in value during marriage, or if you have an account that was started during marriage and at the end of the marriage had $23,000 in it, and that one person contributed 9.8% during the marriage, that's marital property. And the court went on to, and this is when I get to the next step, and this is, I want to make something important here. There's two parts here. There's apples and oranges on the appellant's argument. The awarding of sole possession of the marital home to husband was properly done under Fox. Fox said these are fact-specific cases. In that case, there was jointly owned property, jointly owned debt, and the court could not order an auction. The court could not transfer one to the other. One couldn't buy the other out. because of dire circumstances, consequences to the parties.
But counsel, one of the things also that Ms. Fuller raises is that you can't apportion where there's no value. I think she's arguing it under Hodges.
You can't under Fox. You can transfer a negative asset to a party under Fox. Fox doesn't say you can't do that. Fox comes out and says, after it discusses its three, after it signs a value, it does go on to quote that it is discretionary. Step three, transferring property. The court may transfer or order the transfer of one property to one of the parties or permit the other out. In that case, because of the negative equity and the dire consequences of a division of those parcels, the court chose not to divide these parcels. We conclude that under the specific circumstances of this case, the trial court was not obligated to divide or allocate these two parcels. In this case, she's not on the mortgage. She's not on that debt. Okay? So transferring this property to Mr. Frakes, okay, was the appropriate thing to do, okay, because you couldn't auction it off. And according to the best evidence, she had no evidence of value. She came to court thinking we paid $160 for it, but you have an unfinished second floor, basically almost an unhabitable house with the photographs. And under the Fox case, you do have the authority to transfer a property to one of the parties, even with a negative equity. Now,
the apportionment of the debt and how the court.
Well, how the court did that, and this is what I want to go back. We need to look at subparagraph D of the statute. The court, based upon, one, the equities and rights and interest of each party in the marital property, and two, the factors in subsection E. This judge, very carefully, on page 5, took in consideration of all the facts cited above, okay, and awarded sole possession and ownership of the marital home to husband. Period. Done. That's the first step. The next step, the next thing in terms of the marital award is isolated, is a separate decision. Okay? It's apples and oranges. Further, considering that the husband invested $88,000 into his home from his own Vanguard account, the wife withdrew no monies and reinvested it, and the house has a negative value. The net investment was $111,000. The court followed the statute based upon the equities and the rights and interests of each party in the marital property and the factors in subsection E. The court went through the factors in subsection E on page 4. This has to be read in its totality, the opinion. I don't think you can just carve out one sentence of this opinion and says, the court orders wife to pay 40% of the current net investment into the home, but it's taken as a whole. And the court did consider all the 11 factors. There was no abuse of discretion. The court did consider all of the equities and rights and interests of each of the parties. You have a husband who depleted his retirement account, who paid the contractors to do the work, to live up to his end of the bargain. The wife kept putting 9.8% of her payroll into a 401k account. Her Vanguard account that she was investing in increased in value. The court followed all of that, okay, and allowed her to keep all of her marital assets, all right, and he got a house with negative value. I think the court did an excellent job, and I would ask you to uphold the decision. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Brown? All right, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Brown.
You.
Ms. Fuller, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
First of all, to address the question of, Your Honor, the court did not, in any part of the record, make a determination as to the classification of the retirement accounts. So the first step was entirely missed with regards to those accounts. Their valuation was listed, but there was never any determination on the record as to a classification of those accounts. Secondly, just because there was an increase in value on retirement accounts that occurred during the marriage, it's not necessarily all marital. When we have a situation, as we did in this case, where there was a substantial value in the accounts at the date of the marriage, a portion, and I would submit a substantial portion of that increase, would be attributable to investment earnings and interest on the existing balance. And so that portion would also be considered premarital and separate property if the court was to make that determination, but they did not do so in this case. And carving out what the court did in regards to the $44,000 is very simple to do because the court clearly did it on the record. If we look at the final order, starting on page 5, it indicates the method that the court used to determine the assessment to wife of the $44,400. It states that taking into consideration the facts cited above, this court awards sole possession and ownership of the marital home to husband. Further, considering that husband invested $88,000 into the home from his Vanguard 401k account, while wife withdrew no monies from her Vanguard 401k account and reinvested her earnings, and considering the negative debt to the appraised value of the home to be $23,000, this court finds a net investment in the home of $111,000. So that's the $88,000 that husband invested in the improvements, in addition, added to the $23,000. $23,000 plus $88,000 is the $111,000. Then, having awarded the marital home to the husband, the court orders wife to pay 40% of the current net investment into the home, totaling $44,400. And those funds were to be paid within 90 days. Again, this was an improper method and an incorrect result in this case, Judge, and it needs to be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fuller. We will greet counsel, and then the next case on the docket is Crystal Houston versus City of Newport News Department of Human Services.